From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And today's show is going to be a lot different. I'm doing this remote because of the time sensitivity and the location of where my guests Jeff and Alistair are. But I think it's timely. We're recording this on March 2nd, 2026, and it'll probably post in a day or two. But I guess I want to start the show off by just, with everything that's going on in our world, just express my deep condolences for the war fighters that have lost their lives in the last few days. And we know the world is changing extremely fast. And so today on the show, we have Jeff Wright. He's the founder and CEO of Splash One Robotics, and he's brought along Alistair. How do you pronounce your last name, Alistair?
It's a tricky one for sure. It's Alistair Ayet.
Ayet. Okay, that's what I was going to guess, but it starts with an X, folks. So that's why I was a little hesitant. And we haven't really had a chance to get to know each other, but the way I got introduced to Jeff was through the Veteran Fund, which is a venture capital fund that I'm invested into. I think most of you know, I started the Growth Factory. We do early stage investments. I've been doing the show for the last 10 years, but I've also been doing angel investing and startup investing. And sometimes I invest through funds with my own money. And so when I met Ryan and Mike and the people from the Veteran Fund, I just love their mission. They invest their venture capital dollars into promising startups. And so, and they're veteran owned, which is, a really, that means a lot to me, having my son be a Marine. And so I want to be able to sort of get involved in supporting that effort. But then when I started really looking at their portfolio, I'm like, wow, they're investing in some really badass stuff. And so when the events of the last, over the last weekend cropped up, I thought, wow, maybe I should reach out to Ryan from the Veteran Fund about who might be someone good to talk to around, I guess, issues around what we may be seeing in the way war fighting is changing. And so that's what Jeff and Alistair are here to talk about. So with that said, I didn't even really introduce you guys because I don't know you that well, but maybe I can start with Jeff, maybe just a little bit of your background, because I know you're a veteran, but maybe you share a little of your background and what led you to, this venture.
Sure. I'm Jeff Wright, founder and CEO of Splash One Robotics. I think this is month 7 or 8 for me out of uniform. I only just retired, and I started this company in my garage while I was at US Indo PACOM as the drone strategist and tactician behind a lot of the stuff that's happening in the Western Pacific. I was a Marine artillery officer for the first part of my career, and then got picked up by Air Force Special Operations to keep doing the airstrike and small unit stuff that I've been doing my entire career. Didn't want to grow up and get a real job in the Marine Corps and command big formations. I wanted to stay, jumping out of helicopters and doing all the crazy stuff. And the Air Force gave me the opportunity to keep doing that really almost to the very end of my career. So had the idea for Splash One in uniform, got out. Was very fortunate to raise a pre-seed round, raised 2.75 within 60 days of my retirement and the separation from active duty. Was able to hire some amazing talent like Alistair here and Jesus in the background. And I think he's probably working on the fire control board as we speak. And we're making amazing progress very rapidly because we have a very tight focus on what we're doing. Before that, Alistair, you want to give a quick intro on how you came to be here?
Yeah, so I guess my background, I went to McGill for mechanical and some AI work. And then while I was there, I founded the drone team on the robotics team. And we grew that team from like 2 to 15 people. It was a lot of fun. But from there, most of my experience was really in humanoids. I'd worked on the Optimus project and also at IHMC working on Nadia, which was a DARPA project. But my first role out of college was I worked at the Boring Company as a mechanical engineer, which was fantastic. It was a very great formation. It really gives you rigor in terms of your work and your ethic. And so I did that for a little bit. And then at some point, Jeff reached out. I was like, hey, do you want to do something super cool? And I was like, I'm all ears. And so sort of
did you guys already know each other?
We did not. No.
Okay.
Yeah, it was
like reached for me on LinkedIn. I saw some of the stuff he was working on and what he was posting. I'm like, man, this guy's ethos fits exactly what I want to build. And to tell the truth, I had a little bit of a humbling moment where I'm like, what do I have to offer? I'm a new startup. We are literally taking the furniture out of the boxes and assembling it at this point. Like, we are new. And Alistair's working for an Elon Musk company, a real company, a big company, very well-established name. So I guess one of the things that we could talk about during the conversation here is, for Sacramento startups, if you're going from zero to one, to go from zero to 0.5, like the very first step of it, how do you attract top talent? What are they looking for? Because it's not just dollars. It's not just equity. There's more than that. So there's a pay package that Alistair and I talk about fairly routinely. That's the total experience that we can offer here that nobody else can. By the time you get to be a big, you've got things that I can't offer as a startup, but I can still do things that they can't.
Wow. Well, yeah, let's dive into that a little bit in a minute. Because I do think that that's really, educational for people, maybe some of our audience, of course. And so to me, that's really interesting, especially the talent. You're coming from the Elon Musk group of companies, and to attract you away from that kind of opportunity must have been very attractive. So I look forward to hearing more about that. But Jeff, maybe give me an overview of Splash One to start, and then maybe tell me about those, your backdrop, what's behind you on video, which is, you described them as 9mm bullet holes. So with that said, overview of the company, and then we can get into like what your product does.
Absolutely. So I'll start you in World War II. And in the UK, they're having a problem with German bombers always getting through. And the phrase that's on the lips of all the naysayers at the time is, the bomber will always get through. And it was almost an accepted fact of life that these things are just going to come and we just have to deal with the consequences. And that remained the case until purpose-built fighters were developed. And purpose-built fighters took the performance envelope that was the troubling aircraft and built something directly to counter that. The result was the exact opposite. Bombers can't get through anything unless there's fighters to counter the other fighters. And this led to an era from 1957 until 2017 where no Americans were harmed by enemy fire in combat, by enemy airstrikes in combat. And that started happening again in 2017, not because our fighter jets with all of our high-tech stuff that's going, Mach snot up super high and fast. That wasn't the problem. The problem was that there's a layer underneath that between the surface and the altitude where fighter jets can operate. We call the air littoral, that transitory space where we just didn't have even the ability to lose a dogfight because we didn't have the ability to fight it in the first place. All of our efforts to stop things from the ground weren't working.
Okay.
There's inherent limitations with ground-based systems against aircraft of any kind. And we've known this for a long time. It's just exacerbated when there are drones so low and slow that they're up on you before you know what's going on. And so the only real way to counter this is from the air. And if you're using a drone that sacrifices itself with every use, like a missile that tackles into something and blows up, at best, you have a one-to-one, and we just can't manufacture cheaper than adversaries can take a literal irrigation pipe, weld some wings on it, put a $30 microcontroller on it in an engine, and then make us use one of our high-end systems against that. We get overwhelmed with these things. So we did some math and said, well, what would work is a drone that is reusable indefinitely between engagements, a drone that consumes bullets and batteries, but not itself. So all the expensive stuff that we're pretty good at making in America, that if that persists between missions, and we're also really good with guns, and we put a gun on it, then we can win airborne battles and get us back to a period where the bomber doesn't get through anymore because fighters are now patrolling the skies at 100 feet and below.
Okay, so let me, maybe I'll kind of pull, I'm very naive to this stuff, but I've heard of kamikaze drones, mm-hmm. right? Is that what we're talking about, what they've been using against us is basically taking their drone and running it into something that we have that is as one of our assets, and they lose the drone and it's really cheap, so they don't care. Exactly. Yet it can blow up an aircraft.
Yep, and they even are happy if we shoot a missile at it. because the amount of missiles we have and the cost of those missiles and the replenishment rate of those missiles is so low compared with their opportunity cost to put a cheap target in the air, to where it's damned if you do and damned if you don't. If we let it get through, then some cheap piece of junk just blew up a fifth gen fighter or blew up one of our troops. And if we do use one of our very expensive missiles against it, well, we don't have that thing anymore. And they have defanged us for the cost of that and imposed a cost on our treasury.
Yeah. So because I don't have any images, and I got on your website and it didn't look like you had any images on you're kind of in stealth mode in terms of describing what the products are. Yeah. Is it possible for you to describe what the product looks like to us?
Sure. Yeah. So think of basically a 2 meter or less wingspan, something that is man portable. Really, these things can break down and be transported in a soldier's rucksack that vertically takes off. And then it has fixed wings to go fast and match the speed of these things for patrol for very long ranges and long distances, with a fully autonomous suite of sensors and a computer on board that allows it to see at long ranges, get up right next to the aircraft, and just like a traditional fighter, to do the top gun thing and then gun it down with an autonomously aimed 9mm gun.
And it can gun down these tiny drones too, right? These smaller drones, not just, let's call it a plane.
Right.
A fighter jet or something.
Exactly. Yeah. We're targeting things that are of the drone's own size plus or minus, because you got to kind of be in that class to be in the performance envelope and range of that class.
Okay, paint me a picture of the operator of that. You said that they can break it down and pack it. Can you describe like how you are using them or how you visualize the operation? Maybe just so that everybody, the civilian, can sort of picture what it looks like.
Absolutely, there's a couple of different ways to do this. One of them is that you are. Let's say that we have an army formation that is doing a mission called FARC, the Forward Arming and Refueling Point, where they have to get on helicopters and then land at a bombed out runway or farmer's field or a piece of highway and turn that into an airfield where they refuel aircraft or they refuel helicopters and they put new armament on it. Well, that team that just got off the helicopter is very vulnerable to enemy drones. And what they can't do is take these big towers and big sacrificial things to set up. They've got seconds to set up before they have to be ready. So in this situation, a team of soldiers would have our aircraft with them in either Pelican case or rucksack, jump off the helicopter, get under some cover, assemble it together in a couple of minutes, and then launch it into the air. After it's in the air, they can get back under cover. And that's one of the critical things about air-based air defense. If you're ground-based, you have to sit out there in the open, hoping that you're just not going to get found and targeted. Not good for survival. But in this case, the soldiers who put it together gave it the mission parameters, launched it into the air, then they go back to cover. And the autonomy that's already on this thing, you have the option to either have post-launch control, where you're saying, go to this waypoint, now go here, that thing, go investigate that. Or you can give it mission parameters saying, go to this area and look for this class of targets. When you see X, perform action Y under conditions A, B, and C. And so even if the enemy successfully jams you or the team is busy slugging it out, you know, at a gunfight, a short range, that aircraft can still be doing its job with sufficient level of autonomy.
Yeah. My son, as I mentioned, he was in the Marine Corps. He was infantry, so he's in one of these forward operating units in Afghanistan. He was actually shot in a gunfight, when he came back, I don't remember him telling me anything about. You know, we talk a lot about the entire experience. He's not one of those guys that like had to keep it inside or anything.
Right.
But drones never come up, right? Maybe share with me. And I want Alistair, you jump in too at any point. I'm hearing about drones and, you know, the Ukraine-Russia war, and I'm starting to hear about them and what's going on in Iran, but I hadn't spent a lot of time, you know, even just watching the news, thinking about this that much until really the Ukraine.
Yeah, Alistair, I'll throw a question to you, man, because you led the drone team in the guild. When did this stuff start becoming easy enough to where you can just go online and figure stuff out as opposed to requiring somebody to hand solder stuff. Because yeah, 2010, you couldn't go to, you know, RoboFlow, or you can go to GetFPV. You had to go make stuff. When did we start seeing that change to the democratization of the technology?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, student teams have been doing drones for quite a bit of time, but they haven't really been like military-based. Like we've had agricultural drones for a long time. Our drone's goal was actually to survey lands in the winter to sort of find and track deer populations for like land in Canada. So it wasn't military-specific. But what seems to be the case is that we've had a lot of trouble, even as a student team, sourcing components to make these drones. Getting batteries, for example, was a very, very hard task. And then when we had a crash, we would have to wait 2-3 weeks to get anything going. And so what it seems to have happened is that with the whole push of bringing manufacturing back to the States, for example, we have seen this proliferate a bit more where you can do these things at scale, right? And so your agricultural drone, you don't really care if it's made in America as much, but obviously on the defense side, that's much more important. And so I think that's why we've recently been seeing a big surge in that. And I don't know, like, I'm a civilian. I don't know any classified information, but like just based on like the videos you are seeing in Iran, in Ukraine, like the majority of them are just advancements in drone warfare. Like the whole thing about tethering a fiber optic cable off of a drone is just like, it's a fantastic idea. And it's like, you see these videos and pictures of these spider webs of fiber optics in Ukrainian like meat fields. And in Iran, you see these buildings getting hit by these drones. Like, I have seen more videos of drone attacks online than I have seen about interceptors or ballistic missiles or anything like that, because they're just cheaper. And it's like, you can send so many of them that, as Jeff was saying, like, you can't target all of them. You maybe would target 100 or so, but if they're sending 1,000, 10,000 of them in all directions, you sort of get overwhelmed.
I'm invested in through the Growth Factory in a couple of drone companies. One, we just sold it to another company that it monitors solar farms for, you know, maintenance and stuff like that. And then another one monitors like airport runways and things like that. So that it's basically they're being used so that it saves on labor, right? Basically. And when I think about, you're saving on labor too, obviously a lot, and you're saving the lives of the people, which is really interesting. So
when did your son, when was his last tour in Afghanistan?
He was shot in 2012. So it would have been Sangin.
Yeah, I was there. I was in Sangin in 2012.
Okay. In 2012? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Sorry, late 2011.
Okay, yeah. He was shot like in June 6th or June 7th of 2012 in the leg.
That was right after when I was there. That was a hard fight.
Yeah, he got pulled out on a helicopter and spent. It was. He had a 4-year commitment, so it was like the last. He spent like the last 6 months of his term in Balboa Medical Center.
So
he was in the hospital there. Which, ironically, I was there like the week before because I was supporting the Wounded Warrior Project. Mm. You know, it's just something, you know, philanthropic.
For that deployment, so that was an era before we had the democratization of hobbyist drones. So on that deployment, I took a drone. I took AeroVironment's Raven system. And this was a fixed-wing drone, but building it took exquisite knowledge. You couldn't just go to a hobbyist store and slap parts together. Mm-hmm. This was a very unique thing. There was nothing commercial off the shelf about it. What allowed this to change was in the late 2010s, about 2016, 2017, is when it really happened, is that the hobbyist drone community started to standardize things enough to where just about anybody who is a smart dude who can figure out how to solder things could pull information off the internet and with a credit card order things that were built to work together and assemble it with YouTube University level of knowledge and go to work. 2010, that took PhDs. By 2020, any reasonably intelligent high school kid can pull this off. And that's where the democratization happened. And that's what's allowing us to get to volume quickly. And that's been the thing that's unlocked drone warfare.
And what does that volume look like on the battlefield, I guess? So I'm maybe paint me a picture of what it might look like in Ukraine and Russia. Are there thousands of them? Is it hundreds? I can't even picture what it would look like.
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands?
Hundreds of thousands.
At a time? There's, I mean, how many, like, is it just, they're all over the place in the sky?
All over the place. Your average drone pilot is using a dozen or two a day. And it's, and that's depending on logistical supply. And the success rates of the missions are not high, like maybe one out of 10 will succeed. But when they do succeed, it's with such precision and at such long ranges mm-hmm. that it's like a mortar that instead of hoping that it hits near, you can control the precise time and place of engagement once it gets to the.
And so they track by like GPS. So they lock onto a target and then you, is it, I mean, I've seen that in the movies.
There's different levels. So the most basic level is a radio frequency controlled thing, like a hobbyist racing drone. And with an operator that is looking at the radio frequency spectrum, seeing what the enemy jamming is in that exact hour. Like I'm looking, I have this frequency available. It changes the drone to that. And then if it gets jammed in the middle of it, he loses it and gets another one. But if it gets through, it's just him flying it. It's very much dependent on skill and a little bit of luck to get around the.
And where is he? He's looking through on a monitor based upon what the camera on the drone is seeing.
Yep.
And
then they're wearing goggles.
Okay. Oh, okay. So then when he sees a target, he sees something he wants to shoot it. Does he try to fly into it at this stage? And most of them, he just tries to do a kamikaze thing, fly into the object.
It depends on the guidance. Sometimes they'll go past targets that are lower valued, like infantry or even artillery, to go past that and strike logistics. Or enemy drone pilots are like the high payoff targets these days. But it's all depending on where they are. Sometimes it's worth it to take out a foot soldier with a drone. Sometimes you fly past a tank in order to get to a logistical thing that it makes all the tanks in the region have no ammo or no shield.
I was watching something on YouTube, I think it was yesterday, and it was from some Middle Eastern influencer who spoke English, who was pro, he wasn't against us as Americans. And so he was just trying to describe this for the rest of us. And he said, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard the term, you get droned. And so he says, here's what it looks like. And he showed a little video of some guy riding a motorcycle that was causing problems in Iran. He was a bad guy, and he got droned, and he just basically eliminated. And so I'm kind of like wondering, did the drone fly into that thing? Is that what most of the technology is? Is drones flying into these small targets?
That's what. So there's a couple of different classes. The first one I describe is an FPV kamikaze, where there will be a contact fuse at the front, where when it hits something, it crushes or makes two wires connect and the charge goes off. There's another class that drops grenades, and it's a very precise mortar system. And then there's also a class that is long range, almost like a low cost cruise vessel. And it's fairly slow and fairly low altitude, but there are so many of them that stopping all of them at once is almost impossible. And some of them leak through, and thus you have a low cost that makes the enemy expend countermeasures, and it still gets through.
Okay, so your drone fights those drones.
Exactly.
Okay.
Stopping go ahead.
Okay, I was gonna say, could you just like paint us a picture of what that fight looks like? Because you're saying hundreds of thousands, even a hard amount to fathom. But I can picture 100 in the sky and a drone coming up and fighting 100 potentially. Is that?
Yeah. So when I say hundreds of thousands, I mean that this is over months and quarters. This is the scale that's being employed at any given time over Ukraine. There are thousands in the air at any given point in time. Okay. Some of them are camera drones that are picking up information off the battlefield. Some of them are logistics drones dropping off fresh ammo and food to troops. Some of them are kamikaze drones or bomber drones. It's just there's all manner in the air at once. What we are doing is we're starting with the technically simplest thing to perfect our tech stack before we go both bigger and smaller. But we're going for the middle class of drones that are propeller driven, not jet powered, because that requires a whole lot more complexity. But also not the ones that are so small that shooting them out of the sky is just an incredible challenge. We're going for that middle class that is higher endurance, higher efficiency, longer range. And so our form factor is matching that. We're only doing this as a temporary measure. We intend to get both bigger and smaller once this tech stack is perfected, but it's just really hard. The limiting factor for when the Ukrainians have tried this is pilots. They have the best drone pilots in the world, and it's not even close. Like, it is just a level of dominance that's hard to explain unless you're a drone pilot. You see just how good these guys are and how many of them they have. But even that are limited to about 400 milliseconds of latency. The human brain making the human muscle move, we're at max about 250 milliseconds. And then when you add communications latency from the drone seeing a thing, making the data go back to the human, into the human's eyeball, out to the human's hand, into the controller, and then back to the drone. In terms of machine warfare, that's an eternity. That's, you know, 400-500 milliseconds, and you just can't aim fast enough. And the cameras aren't good enough to see targets really that well anyway. Our big innovation is that we're taking the human cognition and getting that to the front of the battlefield by encapsulating it algorithmically. And then taking a human controlling the sticks as an optional thing, to where if there is no human available or if communications are jammed, the machine still does it, and then it tracks and shoots at machine speeds.
Okay. And to add to that, I think that's part of why we're able to do it now as well, is because a lot of these systems are compute limited, right? So even like state-of-the-art computer vision software and state-of-the-art like Jetson boards and Orin boards, you can only draw so much power to do so much computation when you're flying in the sky. And we've only recently seen that advancements from NVIDIA, for example, to be able to put those electronics on such a small scale, low power drone, right? You can't be socking like 20 amps just to like have a computer vision working. And so to reduce this inference time, and reduce the latency, we really need these highly optimized systems. And that's really where the complexity in what we're doing comes from. It's like, because you could easily think, oh, if a hobbyist can make a drone, then like what we're doing is really not that state of the art. But it's actually integrating these highly advanced compute systems and autonomy behavior into a not hobbyist grade, but a, like it's not like we're building an F-35 here either, but a fairly advanced hobbyist drone that's able to do a lot of different tasks at the same time, right?
They're doing all that calculation at the edge inside the drone itself. There's nothing going back to
right, because you want to prevent having to have those umbilicals all the way back to the command chain. Right. And so, if you want to have this self-contained system, you really have to add a lot of tech just inside a pretty small form factor.
So, see, I'm thinking out loud here. So maybe help me with this. So if money is no object, human lives are the only thing, why would I have the person with the joystick or the controllers do it? Why not just launch just as many as needed to go work by themselves?
So Alistair, you want to talk a little bit about the challenge of CV against cluttered background compared with clean background?
Yeah. So, some of the best computer vision out there, and I know there are some systems that have very specialized cameras, and you can see thermally as well that can aid. So obviously, the more sensors you have, the better your algorithm can decipher drones. But for the cameras that we're using that are pretty low power, low cost, we're looking at maybe at most in the hundreds of meters of CV range. A battlefield can be hundreds of kilometers wide, right? So we really have to add other sensors that are beyond like visual, that really aid, and you sort of fuse them together with your computer vision.
For the strictly the air to ground piece, the big challenge is that picking out a target against the ground is really, really hard. Mm-hmm. Our eyes and our brains are highly evolved to that specific task. So it looks easy to us, and it is far from easy for a machine, especially when that target's trying very hard not to be found. We are nowhere near technologically ready for air-to-ground systems to pick out targets with anything like the skill of a human. Air-to-air is a different story. Air-to-sea is a different story. But if you're trying to find a trench line and see where in that trench line to strike, today that really takes a human.
And in your back behind you, there's bullet holes.
Yeah.
What happened there? Is that one of your drones got after that piece of, I don't know if it's a piece of metal or what it is.
Yeah, so this is carbon fiber, and this is my green screen that I have up. And what this is from some of our live fire testing. When we did our lethality analysis, deciding, you know, hey, what caliber bullet do we want to use? What type of gun do we want to use? We did this fall of 2024. We were really surprised to find that a straight penetration, even by 12-gauge shotgun or 50 caliber bullet, it was not nearly as lethal against these drones as we thought it was going to be. And then we kind of remember, oh yeah, didn't Abraham Wald already teach us that in World War II with the red dots on the bomber to show all the places you can shoot a bomber when it doesn't fall out of the sky? And subsequently, we've had a lot of experience in the U.S. government and in Ukraine that have shown that bullets, they are very effective, but you have to shoot a lot of them and they have to hit the right place. But we don't have that luxury when we're carrying our ammo aloft. You can't just go P equals plenty and shoot a lot. So what we've done is developed a proprietary bullet, formulation of which is definitely a trade secret, but it breaks apart when it hits the target and it spreads into the aircraft itself. And what you're seeing here are some of the failed tests where it blew through the back. And you'd think that an exit wound like this is as good as desirable. And it's certainly a heck of a lot better than, you know, even 20, 25 millimeter. But The special sauce is a trick we got up our sleeve with what's inside our bullet itself that we really think will be at about a one shot, one kill for a 9mm round against almost any drone.
So that's one bullet.
Each one of these is a single round.
Oh, each one of these is a single
round. These are the exit wounds from a formulation that was still in development. And I show that, hey, this is the failure. This is what when we over penetrate and we don't keep the bullet inside the target, this is what it looks like. And it's still gnarly. This stuff will deform. It'll cause parasitic drag that'll take an aircraft outside of the control envelope super quick, in addition to damaging anything in between. But if you think this is gnarly, when the bullet's retained properly inside the aircraft, that's when the magic happens and we get to that one shot, one kill.
So I believe Donald Trump signed an executive order last year that wants to make us like the drone people, I guess, and the U.S. be, you know, prioritize that in our budget and in our strategy. Did that maybe talk to us about that? And did it affect your business? How might that have affected you guys?
Definitely has affected us. We started this and we were skating to where the puck was going. Definitely we're ahead of the customer. And to hear the drone dominance demand signal and the Pentagon kind of waking up collectively and saying, man, this is a big problem. And every time we have another incident where Americans, unfortunately, are killed in action from drones, the human cry gets stronger. So definitely good for the business. But the caveat is that what we're trying to do is to get caught up with the state of the art. And the reason we got in the position to where we aren't the state of the art in the first place is that we've been consistently shooting behind the duck. We've been going to where technology is instead of doing that concurrently with saying, and where is it going? What is the next big thing? And then getting those bets right. So I'm not saying by any means that our drone dominance isn't the answer, because it is. Like, what we're trying to do by catching up to the world leaders, Ukraine, that is exactly what we should be doing. But it's not the limit of what we should be doing. We should also be asking, and what comes next? Splash One's answer for that is that these kamikaze drones, they have to get all the way to target to matter. So brings up a scenario like on a Middle Ages battlefield, where if you've got knights in plate mail on horses, and you have longbows at Agincourt that can take them out from 100, 200 meters away, well, suddenly the knight in plate mail doesn't look so good. If he can't even get all the way to target because there's somebody with a long-range ability to take him out, that's what we're building. This entire push for kamikaze drones is shooting behind the duck. It's getting us caught up with the current state of the art in 2026. That is not the state of the art for 2030. This is going to be battles between drones that are shooting each other from 10, 20, 50 meters away, like normal fighter combat. Whoever wins those creates low altitude air superiority, and only their drones can succeed. And from there, it's a mop up. Just like in Agincourt, once your heavy horse is down, then it's just rolling over the enemy forces and they suffer what they must.
So the air superiority piece, that just basically clears the way for you to do the rest of what you've got to do.
Exactly. Or if we lose, to suffer the enemy's drone dominance.
We're definitely the midfielder in terms of this, right? Like, you could either prevent people from sending drones at all, which we tend to be pretty good at. And then there's also the last mile defense, where you have like pretty, you have ground stations, but they have a very narrow protection area. So we want to be the middle ground between the two. We want to, if it does manage to launch, and there's a lot of them, we want to sparse it down as much as possible before it becomes unmanageable on that last barrier. Like, we don't want these drones falling out of the sky 100 meters away from their targets. We want them being dropped out of the sky maybe to 20, 30, 40 kilometers out, because a lot of times you also have people in the areas around bases and stuff. So the last thing you want is you shoot a drone down, it doesn't hit its target, but it accidentally hits a car or another building. And so we really want to avoid those secondhand casualties.
And as I think about startups versus let's call it the household name defense contractors, Lockheed, Boeing, these ones come to mind for me in terms of like who's making stuff. You know, these bigger corporations, they don't move like you guys move, right? And they don't just to decide to build a new product might take, a lot of red tape just to make the decision. So talk to me about that and the speed of the way, how fast technology is changing right now in AI and so many different areas of our economy. But in terms of weapons systems, defense systems, it's the type of thing where we have to be ahead of the competition, and relying on a slow moving government agency or a slow moving, major defense contractor that's paying union, trying to manage their unions.
Yeah.
I just don't see how they can compete with this.
Bingo. And that question was asked by almost every one of our investors is, well, what happens if Anduril turns around and they want to do this? What happens if, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, any of those decide that they want to do this? My response is, good luck catching a startup. I can't tell you how many times Alistair and I have had Thai food at the desk he's at like 11 o'clock at night on a Tuesday, because we're passionate as hell about getting this done. If you're passionate, you're willing to burn it down and move with the speed and agency that we have, you're probably not going to a startup. If you do have that quality is associated with startups, and that's how we move faster than anybody else. Go fast with few and far with many. And so I think the play here is that the large primes, and I'll include Anduril in that, they're probably looking at all of the options right now, deciding whom to acquire. Because we will not be able to go as far as we could if we had a big name backing with us. So I think that's where the M&A play comes in, is that at some point, a company like ours would make an amazing progress as a scrappy startup. And then a large prime that says, this makes sense. And I can either try to have my people create it from scratch or acquire them. I think that's the nature of this game.
Yeah. And maybe, Alistair, too, before I forget, what made this opportunity? I'm sure it wasn't for the upfront signing bonus that got you there. So what brought you there other than helping? Was there like a purpose? Was it a purpose driven decision? Talk to us about like how that might work for and because Jeff kind of set that up at the beginning, is like you got to get the right talent if you're going to be successful as a startup. But it's hard. That's tough when you don't have a lot of cash.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons that you can go either way. Like, I have no complaints again about the Boron Company. It's a fantastic company, but I think there are a few key things that really sold me to Splash One specifically, right? Cause there were a lot of other drone companies that reached out around the time as well. I think to me, the biggest thing is like, I believe in people more than I believe in ideas. And I think the team that Jeff and Jeff himself specifically is just, they're irreplaceable in this space. Like the combination of know-how of being in the field and having done it before with some good technical understanding, as well as getting the right people at the right place and knowing sort of how the government works, I think was really, really sold me on the idea of Splash One, just being able to have a mentor like that. And then second, again, like the pace at which you move here, and like Elon companies are really fast, but even at those companies, you still have some red tape to go. When I create a design, we have a design review together, and then it goes through one or two layers of approval, and then we have to send it out to a purchaser who takes maybe a week or two to get the stuff purchased, and then that has to get approved, and then the stuff arrives, and there's just so much going on, right? And it makes sense because the Boring Company is it's a billion-dollar company, so they need to have these standard operating procedures. We're the ones here creating those SOPs, right? We can dictate how you want a company to run, what kind of tech stack you want to do, and that also allows to, on the personal side, be like, okay, I think this is a very unique technology that I think would work on the drone. Maybe you spend 1 or 2 days trying it out, and then it's like, oh, this is great, or this is not great. And then from there, you move on. You're able to take a lot more risk in these things, and I'm not risk averse. Let's put it that way. So, yeah,
I think that's the main two. I think about what Jeff's motivation might be, and I'm picturing myself as somebody who's, if I'm you, you've spent time in the trenches, you've seen the casualties of war, and the number. You think about the number of lives that get saved when the warfighters have the right tools. Maybe talk to us about your motivation for this, and obviously protecting America, right? Protecting the good guys.
I'll start with an acknowledgement of who's not on the podcast right now, is that Dr. Heather Hussein, my CTO, and Patrick McGlynn, the co-founding chief engineer, both of them are married to active duty Air Force Special Operations Command personnel. And so they are very busy right now with what's going on in the world. And it's what we're building isn't for some theoretical thing. We're building to protect the people we love, my former teammates, our co-founders' spouses who are in harm's way. They're the people that I have, kind of a blood debt to for making me, getting me through the hard times that I've been through, and the people that I love and the cause that I love. America is worth it. And the idea of what we're working on for the bigger picture, it is a big part of it, but it's just deeply personal. I know what it's like to be targeted by enemy fire and not have an answer to it. It is a type of terrifying that's difficult to describe. So you've experienced it. And having been in training on the receiving end of airstrikes, just that helpless feeling of looking up and saying, man, that's it. There's nothing I can do here. And then getting to have employed drones in combat myself a couple times, small ones. It's an unfair advantage that the enemy currently has, and we've got to deny it to them. So we started this company specifically to return control of the skies to America. We're going to make a ton of money along the way. Yes, investors, don't worry about that. Like, we are definitely going to make a lot of money because Pentagon's throwing money at the SOS Congress. But that's not the point. The point of this is that we are de-risking the rest of your portfolio by ensuring that the free world can't be disrupted by bad actors with a couple of cheap drones. So there's a defense play here, but this is also de-risking the rest of the portfolio. It's a mission that's rooted in a big picture and a commitment to the people.
Okay. Well, I thank you for that. And I've only got a couple more questions left, if you don't mind. In terms of building this type of company, the timing feels really good for it. You mentioned that, maybe an acquisition ends up being somewhere, something that you look for down the road. What has to happen? Obviously, the product needs to get built. Do you have to commercialize it first? I mean, what needs to happen in order to have that go right?
Great question. And total candor here. Man, this is my first time running a small business, my first time running a startup. So everything I know about here is because my advisors, my investors have been teaching me along the way. And any gaps in knowledge are mine and mine alone. The strategy that we have is that we're focused ruthlessly on delivering the results to the warfighter. And we know that at every stage of the company's development, that there's good profit to be made. If we go all the way to IPO, if we become an established thing, fantastic. We know that we are in the ground floor of the next big thing. In 1905, if you talked about building a company based on airplanes shooting each other, people would have thought you were nuts. And yet, Lockheed Martins of the world, the Boeings of the world, they were created by somebody. They were a startup at one point. Mm-hmm. Splash One is a startup at the edge of the next big thing. We can absolutely go all the way to a public offering. If we are acquired at any of our stages, man, well, if it helps us to deliver the product faster and better to do more, I'll entertain it all day. I also have a fiduciary duty to my investors to consider those offers as well. And I think it's just going to scale. Right now, we have a functioning prototype. It's flying, detecting targets, shooting stuff out of the air. But we are still early in development with some of the subsystems, and we're integrating them. So there's still risk. Every time we turn idea into functional plastic and metal that works in the real world, we're de-risking it further. Our valuation is going up. And so always open to having conversations at each stage of development. But the North Star remains the same. The North Star service, the Warfighter service to the nation. Whatever we can do, that's going to result in that down.
So yeah, as long as you make a good product, keep your head down. At some point, someone will notice. And yeah, that's like when we're not waking up every day, it's like, oh, are we getting acquired today? It's like, you know, can we make the system better?
Yeah. And having the time of life when we're doing it. Like Alistair has creative control. What are you, like, you're 23, Alistair?
Like, I'll say
dude, you've got the ability to shape aerospace history here. And so we are having a blast doing it. It's rewarding. Every time we see it actually work, you know, shoot stuff down automatically, it's like magic, and it just doesn't get old, and we're having a blast.
So when you go to test it, to paint me a picture of what it looks like to go test it, is that, did one of you guys have like 100 acres to go test it on, or do you go rent a space?
There's two answers.
So currently we go out to a field near Atlanta. It is populated by mostly cows, but we set up there in between the dung, and we sort of take off the aircraft, turn on our autonomous systems, and sort of do the test cars that we need to do. We try and be obviously as professional as we can, but like, we're not crash averse. For example, if our drone crashes, we're not going to spend the next month writing a report card on it and figuring out why a specific thing failed. You build it again and you keep crashing until you figure it out, and you just move fast and learn fast that way.
So Alistair, can you tell the story real quick about in the backyard of the Airbnb, how we had a hard landing and how you got the system back up, and it was like with super glue and a pine cone?
Yeah, part of our case is probably duct tape, epoxy, and some super glue. And so when we try and make our systems as robust as possible, and I forget the exact scenario that happened, but it just fell out of the sky, maybe 20, 30 meters in the air, hit the ground. You have the wing sort of broken and like flexing upwards. We just looked at it, added some epoxy, waited 30 minutes, and then took off again. And because like it wasn't a core component for that test, and so we just make do with what we can.
That's awesome. Okay, two more questions then. And paint me a picture, if you will, maybe your vision there. And maybe this goes to both of you, because Alistair, you worked for, you talked about working on Optimus. And so you can picture what the humanoid robot is being designed to do. And, you know, that's almost hard to imagine, but it forward thinking about drone technology and weapons, what do we visualize? Obviously, you guys are building your MVP, if you will, and you know, and we see where the puck is now at some level. But where will it be in, say, 5 or 10 years? Like when we picture Optimus out there, you know, cleaning our kitchen for us, that's kind of easy to imagine. But what might that look like in a defense or attack system?
Alistair, let's take a crack at this one, and then I'm going to take us back to Jules Verne.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the difference with Optimus is that although it's doing your dishes, the dishwasher isn't fighting back, right? So it's a lot easier to design a system. Well, I mean, I'm not saying humans are easy in any way, but it helps that your system is fixed, right? Like the dishwasher isn't going to change in the next 5 years. Our opponents are going to be changing, right? So whether they put a sort of flare in the back, or they have these like infrared deflectors, there's a lot of things they can start doing. They can harden their systems more. There's a lot of things they can do to make our lives a lot harder. And so I can say exactly where we'll be doing in the next 5 years. But I think we'll do a lot of cool stuff. And I think drones are not going anywhere. They will be, if not, like they might become like the core part of American doctrine in terms of warfare, especially on like not on big country to big country scale, but on these sort of skirmishes we're seeing.
And as I listen to, you know, stuff on robotics and things on YouTube and watch that stuff, I get the understanding that these AIs are teaching themselves, right? Eventually, you know, one robot learns it. They all have learned it. You don't have to go reprogram everything. Is that what you envision?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
How far away are we from that kind of thing?
I think we're not, it depends how far you want to implement it. Like having full autonomy, teaching full autonomy, we're still quite a ways away from that. But there are smart ways we can do to try and get that human aspect into our tech. And one of my favorite fun examples was that, like, let's say you were to create a Steam game, for example, where players are manipulating your robot, you sort of get those user inputs and sort of try and teach an algorithm to play like a human would. Right. Mm-hmm. And so there are just like how captchas work, right? Like we trained Waymo by accident in the last 15 years by having us work for Google for free. Right. So I think there's a lot of innovative ways that we can do to get our autonomy better, to make it learn by itself. But I think for now, we're definitely going to have a lot of human input in these systems. Okay. It's also in terms of like for ethical reasons as well. Right. The last thing you want is a completely black box thing making decisions that are life or death.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Jeff, go ahead. You wanted to share.
Yeah, so I'm gonna be a contrarian. I'm gonna say that looking to humanoids is the same as in the Jules Verne era, where that era's futurists predicted what the future was gonna look like. Humanoids are interesting but not compelling because our bodies are mid-tier at everything. We care about humanoids because they look like us, they evoke emotions. Xenophanes, the ancient Greek philosopher, you know, his take on it was that if horses had fingers it could draw, they would draw gods that looked like horses. And for that reason, that's why Terminator was the big movie about the scary AI robot. Not because the 6-foot bipedal thing with arms is worth a damn, but because it looks like us and Arnold's super handsome. Like that's why we care about humanoids. But it just doesn't work. It doesn't work for defense for a bunch of reasons. Give you an example. If you have a 6-foot humanoid robot, you have sensors that are at most 6 feet in the air. That's really low to the ground. And then once the shooting starts, probably a little bit lower than that. But if you have a quadrotor drone, you can look at 6 feet, 60 feet, 600 feet, 6 inches, just as easily as 6 feet. And so once you untie yourself from a humanoid or even a quadruped, once you're no longer stuck on the ground, you have a degree of freedom that every military historian in history or a theorist in history has wanted. Like your son at the basic school was taught to take a hill. Why do we care about hills? Elevation. Elevation is inherently valuable. You can take elevation in half a second by putting power to a quadrotor drone and getting higher. We can also move a heck of a lot faster. Your son going over the obstacle course at TBS, like it takes a lot of effort, and a humanoid could do that. Yeah. Or our quadrotor could just fly over it in a, you know, fraction of a second. Humanoids ain't it. They are what we have imagined for so long, but that prediction will fade into history the same way that the Jules Verne steampunk era faded into history. Like nobody expects Rosie the robot anymore. But that's the 1950s, what we thought was going to be the cool thing. So what's coming next is scarier.
Yeah, yeah. And the premise of my question, it wasn't around the humanoid specifically. Yeah. It was more around when I've heard Elon Musk or others talk about what's going on over at Tesla and that they're going to be building millions of these things, right? So I'm assuming, you know, whoever has the... Let's put the humanoids to the side. Yeah. Whoever has the quantity and quality combination that can be produced at scale is going to control the board. And so you could build a million of them and then build the new model of a million. And the new model would update the old models, kind of like because they're smart enough to do that. That's where my head was, and I don't even know if that.
Oh,
was
totally. And that's if you separate the physical thing from the agentic pilot of the thing. And agentic AI, definitely the next big thing. You can train, you know, millions of reps in simulation at a speed that you could never do in real time. So 100% agentic AI as a way of controlling whatever hardware factor is best at the moment. So I think you're going to see a race to the top for agentic AI and a race to the bottom for hardware. Whatever's cheapest is going to win. And then whatever is best is going to win on the software side.
Okay, so last, I actually have one more question. I don't know if you want to answer this or not, but what is your... I've seen like Anthropic has gotten blackballed, if you will, from buying, selling into the defense industry at some level. You have perspective on that?
Yeah, I know a lot of people involved in it. First off, just I use Claude personally. Like it's a really good model. Of all the ones that I use routinely, it seems to be the best for a lot of reasons. And I know that a lot of people in uniform have been using it as well. That said, man, don't piss off your customer. Maybe don't piss off your customer, especially when you read the terms and conditions that they're talking about. It is already stuff that's against our policy. So it was a thing where it was a self-inflicted wound by some people on the Anthropic team who didn't read the room right and were trying to signal to non-DoD people, and that signal just got smacked right out of their heads. So badly misread by the Anthropic team responsible, unless it's a bigger signal, unless it's a sacrificial move to drum up support from people who wanted that to happen. And then on the Gov side, it's a loss because Claude's a great model. All the stuff that it can do being removed, it's unfortunate. So we got to a lose-lose, except for the signaling that may be win-win.
Okay. Okay, what did I not ask you guys? This is my final question. What did I not ask you? What other piece of information would be, helpful or maybe just good for anybody in our audience? Because it's not all entrepreneurs and investors. Some of it's just, good, hardworking Americans.
Alistair, I bet you take first crack at that, man.
Whew. I don't know where to start. I mean,
agoraphobia.
I think, be willing to take risks. And I think believe in yourself. Sometimes there will be a lot of things that will try and stray you from what you think is core to who you are. And so if you truly believe in a mission, pursue it, and there'll be a lot of people along the way. I'm sure when Jeff was creating this, if you told someone about this 5 years ago, they're like, this is kind of a crazy idea, but he still went along and made it happen. And hopefully we can see it to fruition. So definitely stick to it.
I love it.
I would ask a question, Mark, that I think most investors should ask right now is that if there's a drone bubble, and I submit that there is, and I've posted on LinkedIn about the fact that I think that we're in a drone bubble. How do you make investments that take advantage of being this sector being the obvious big winner going forward in military technology? Like this is a huge thing. And yet it's saturated in so many places. I hear all the time from investors that I hear the word drone and my eyes glaze over. And I've seen it. Like in the past 2 weeks, I gave a pitch and I could just see two of the people in the audience that they heard the word drone and just, oh my God, like another drone company. So how do you differentiate between pets.com in 1998 and the dot-com bubble and Amazon? Because if you have a crystal ball to the future, then you know that one is going to be the next big thing and one gets your money out because it's going to zero. But unless you have a combination of foresight and expert market knowledge, you're just rolling the bones. And if you're putting money in the drone space at all, you could be hitting it big with the next one, or you could be on just another thing that's going to zero because it's not differentiated. So my advice to those people is, man, get a hold of people who actually know what's going on. There were significant decisions made in the Pentagon about what drones we were going to buy by people who had never held a soldering iron in their hands, people who had never written a line of code, people who had never flown a drone. You have to know what the hell you're talking about to navigate a complicated market like this. Just like in 1998, my advice to VCs would be, man, get someone on your team who can code, get someone who is a native to this skill set and knows what's going on. Maybe they don't understand the market. Maybe they got, you know, flaws and faults like all of us do, but you got to have expert knowledge to navigate this space right now. It's very tempting to say, well, this is what the customer is asking for. That's almost an indication of what I would not invest in. If the customer's already asking for it, it means it's too late for a startup to go after it. If their customer isn't asking for it, if there is no capital R requirement, there's your opportunity for venture scale returns. If you want a lifestyle business, the great investment model, very cool. And there's plenty of spaces to do that in for people who've already proven government traction with the government requirement. But if you want venture scale returns, if you want a 10X, 100X, you got to put your money to the thing that no one is asking for yet, that is the next logical sequence after what the customer is asking for and what's hot on the battlefield today.
I love it. Well, thank you guys. This is good timing because the whole world's thinking about war, not just because of Ukraine, but now what's going on in Iran. You know, we're going to be thinking about this stuff. And when you hear about people losing their lives, you think about what kinds of technology is going to be preventative. So I appreciate just the project you're working on, the company that you're building, not just from, because I'm a small time investor into this venture fund, this is great for America. So thank you.
Appreciate the time.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Thank you guys.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage. And of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at the Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.